The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I'm going to talk about things as they are. In our mindfulness practice, in our daily lives, as well as in our sitting practice, we try to bring our attention to the present moment as much as possible, letting go of thoughts, ideas, views, opinions, judgments, reactions about what's happening in the present moment, as much as possible to what is actually happening in the present moment. Why do we do this? The understanding in the way our minds work, and which I think many of you see as you engage in this meditation practice, it doesn't actually take very long to see that a lot of the reasons why we end up in struggle, in dissatisfaction, in suffering is because of these reactions, these judgments, these views, these ideas, these beliefs. And that if we could connect to our experience directly, instead of through this filter of views and opinions and reactions, that we'd actually be a lot happier. There'd be a lot more ease in our lives. So there's a term in the Buddhist texts used for this idea or this meeting our experience directly. And the term, the Pali term, is yata bhuta. And it is translated in different ways, but one of the main ways it's translated is things as they are. And I'd like to explore tonight this topic of things as they are, looking at this from different perspectives suggested by some of the different translations of this term. So there's three translations of this term I'd like to explore tonight. One is things as they are. A second version of this translation, which Gil actually pointed out to me earlier last week, is that the tense of the term is a past participle. So the literal translation is something along the lines of things as they have come to be, which adds a different flavor, a different spin to the understanding. And the third translation, which is often used, is as it actually is. So I'm just going to explore from these three translations a little bit about this idea or the recognizing, connecting with things as they are. So the first, things as they are. To me, this speaks to the fact that the present moment experience is given. Things have happened. There is something that is already here. Something is already happening. Things as they are. Something is already happening. But what we typically do, or often what happens for us, is that we struggle with this thing that is given, thing that is already here. We struggle with it. We wish it were some other way. We wish it were some other way. And that wishing itself actually is the source of our unhappiness. If we could just be contented with things as they are, we wouldn't be dissatisfied with things as they are. So the very act of wishing things to be some other way is the struggle, is the suffering. Or if things are things as they are is a way that we particularly like it in the moment, we think that we figured things out, that this is the way things are supposed to be, this is right, this is good, and we either try to hold on to it, or we suffer when it changes, because it does change. Things as they are is not ad infinitum as they are, but a continually changing flow of things as they are. So we can come into balance around things as they are when we learn to let go of wishing it were otherwise and learn to accept that it will change. Ajahn Sumedho has a great little phrase that he offers. It's like this, just really pointing to things as they are. This is, in a sense, another, and actually I just read earlier today another way that this term yatha bhuta is sometimes used is as referring to truth. And what that means is that it refers to the truth of things as they are. That things as they are is the truth by definition. It is what is happening, what is already here, and that is the truth. And when we come into alignment with that truth, there's a kind of a feeling of acceptance, a feeling of release, a feeling of relaxation that happens when we let go of struggling, of wishing it were otherwise, or trying to keep holding on to something as it is. The second translation for this term, yatha bhuta, things as they have come to be, to me this one brings in a sense of process, of how things come to be. That there is, in that phrase, things as they have come to be, an implication of process. So the things having come together in this moment, it's not a random confluence of events. There's a lot of things coming together in this moment, but there are many different natural processes at work that brought all the pieces together to make things come to be. There's a confluence of many events and many choices that have happened, many choices that we have made, events from our life, from our history that have come together, and things that are really a lot outside of our control as well. You know, natural laws, physical laws have come together to put us in this place in this time. Laws of heredity have shaped how we are, how we look, how we function, how people respond to us. There's many, many different pieces that come together to shape this moment. It's almost as if we can think about, you know, the whole of all the causes and conditions of all the history that we have come together into this moment to create your experience here and now. I mean, even just reflect for a few seconds on what are the conditions that brought you here tonight? They're so vast, actually, the conditions, the causes and conditions that come together to create a moment, that the Buddha says that the normal human mind can't really comprehend the vastness of it, and that one would go mad trying to comprehend the vastness of it. So we can't really comprehend all of the pieces that come together to make this moment. And yet there are certain pieces, certain laws that are very helpful to recognize, to understand, and that we can actually see and understand some of their function. And understanding some of their function can be very supportive for us in terms of accepting, settling into things as they have come to be. So the main natural law in terms of the way our minds work is the law of karma. And the basic understanding around this is that our choices, the choices that we make, have an impact on our experience. And that there's an ethical component to that impact. That essentially, if we act with a skillful intention, with an intention of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that the result of that at some point in our experience, maybe not immediately, but at some point in our experience, will be a moving away from suffering. If we act out of greed, aversion, or delusion, then the natural impact of that, at some point we will suffer. Now this is understood to be a natural law. It's the choices that we make, the intentions that are associated with greed, aversion, or delusion, or non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Those intentions are like seeds. And this analogy is used in, the Buddha used this analogy, that from a seed, a certain kind of plant can grow. So from an apple tree, apple seed, an apple tree will grow. You won't get an orange tree when you plant an apple seed. That won't happen. That is not within the realm of that natural law, that being a law of genetics. Apple seed produces, or has the capacity, let's say it has the capacity to produce an apple tree. And yet, that seed may or may not immediately produce an apple tree. And the analogy breaks down a little bit because that seed may never produce an apple tree. But given the right conditions, you plant that seed in soil that has moisture and nutrients and the right temperature, and that seed will grow into an apple tree. So it's similar with our choices, that the choices related to greed, aversion, and delusion are like a seed that will eventually sprout into some kind of suffering. The actions that are rooted in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion is like planting a seed that will eventually sprout in happiness, in non-suffering. And it's the conditions in which those seeds are planted that result in when those seeds sprout. They may sprout immediately, they may not sprout for a long time. The understanding in this law of karma is that they will sprout at some point. That if you behave ethically, that you are destined to towards happiness. If you behave unethically, you are destined to head towards suffering. At some point. So, things as they have come to be kind of reflects an understanding that our experience is a result of lawful processes. Now, these are non-deterministic processes, and that because as I was giving the example around the seeds, you know, that seed of a particular kind of ethical choice, in one sutta the Buddha said, the same one person having behaved in one way, having behaved with an act of ill will, in this very life experiences almost no results of that. And another person may experience immediate and very strong results of that. And it kind of depends on the climate in which that experience is made. If there is a kind of a wholesome climate in the mind, a small movement of ill will be felt as suffering, perhaps as a small suffering. Another analogy around this is that if you have some salt, a teaspoon of salt, if you put that salt into a glass of water, you're not going to be able to drink the water. But if you put that salt into a large body of water, you're not going to notice that salt is impacting the flavor of the water. So the climate into which these actions happen impacts the results. So it's not a deterministic kind of thing. It's not saying that if you behave this way, then you get this result. It's much more fluid than that. In my experience with exploring this understanding around karma, I see that contemplating it supports an understanding or supports a kind of a letting go into equanimity, into a balance of mind. Because in a way, you know, when we have events happen to us, you know, I remember feeling really buffeted around by things, at the mercy, in a way, of things, of the way people behaved, and why do they have to behave that way, and why do they have to do those things? That, you know, look how it impacts me that they're doing these things, even though it has nothing to do with me. In my mind, it had something to do with me. And feeling really buffeted around by the experiences of life. And when I began bringing my attention into the moment and recognizing things are happening lawfully, there's a kind of way in which my mind relaxed. It's like, oh, I see. I'm reacting because of causes and conditions. There's some of my history that's coming in here, and some of other people's history that's coming in here, and it's all kind of mixing up, and it's producing this reaction. So it allowed me to be a little more at ease around my own reactivity, to be a little more accepting of my own reactivity. Oh, this reactivity is coming out of causes and conditions. It helped me to not take it so personally. And that's one of the real benefits of understanding this teaching around karma, is that we do begin to see that things happen as a result of causes and conditions. And that it's not so personal. It's not really about me. Another aspect around this teaching of karma is that everything has been created in this moment. Things have come to be in this moment based on things from the past. And our choice here and now, our choice on how we respond to things as they have come to be, can directly impact the immediate climate of our minds. And this is how we begin to turn our battleship of reactivity, which, you know, is really steamrolling in one direction. Slowly, slowly, we can begin to change its course through our choices in this moment. And this is really the good news, that the choices that we make or that are made, because nobody is really there making them, choices are made, conditions come together to support a choice. The choices that are made can change the course of our life and change the whole climate of the way we feel in this moment. I know many of you have had this experience of, in meditation or in daily life, recognizing something arising, recognizing a feeling of fear, or recognizing a feeling of irritation or anger or some difficult experience. And when it is recognized with mindfulness, in that moment, there can be a shift of perspective. That the fear doesn't go away or the anger doesn't go away necessarily, but our relationship to it changes. Through that choice of meeting experience with mindfulness, the whole climate of our mind shifts. And it no longer feels quite like suffering. Sometimes it can actually be interesting. Wow, look at that. This mind is doing this pattern yet again. So in the moment, we can begin to see this process working of things coming to be, not just things as they have come to be, but the process in work, the process in play, of things arising and resulting in a change in experience. Cause and effect, cause and effect. We can witness this in our experience. And that witnessing has an even more powerful impact on our understanding, our recognition that this is just a process happening here. And supporting that settling back again into balance of mind. Settling back. The third translation of this term yata bhuta is as it actually is. You know, and this phrase is actually all over the suttas. You know, it just kind of, until I had it pointed out to me, you know, I didn't actually notice it as a thing, you know, to pay attention to. But it's all over the place in the suttas. The Buddha talks about seeing, understanding as it actually is, our feelings, understanding as it actually is, our body, understanding as it actually is, our perception, understanding as it actually is, the First Noble Truth. This is all over the place. So the thing I want to key in on here in this part, in this translation, is the word actually. To me, this word actually points to an understanding. And actually, this phrase, as it actually is often talked about with respect to understanding. We understand the Four Noble Truths the First Noble Truth as it is. We understand the body as it actually is. So there, it's connected with this idea of understanding as it actually is. It points to me, this term actually points to an understanding that is free from bias, opinion, views, beliefs, reaction, judgment. It recalls to me this teaching, this famous teaching on the Bahiya Sutta, from the Bahiya Sutta, where an ascetic came to the Buddha and asked him to teach him what he had to teach in brief. And the Buddha responded by saying, "This is how you should train yourself. In the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. In the sensed is only the sensed. In the cognized is only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself." So that's really pointing to direct experience, things as they are without judgment, views, opinions. In the seen is only the seen. It points to what we can call bare attention, which is a kind of way of bringing our attention to experience without judgment, without agenda, without reaction, without a story. And if those judgments, views, reactions, stories arise, bare attention understands those as they actually are, as simply arising experiences in the mind. In the cognized is only the cognized. Now, these agendas, these judgments, views, opinions have a tendency to obscure things as they are. We walk around with clouds or filters over our ability to see things. And as long as we don't see that we have those filters operating, then our ability to touch into things as they are is compromised. We can't see things as they are if we are looking at things through a view or a filter of anger. It's coloring our experience. We can't see things as they actually are if we're looking at things through a filter of agenda. This is what I need to do with this experience. But if we turn our attention to the fact that an agenda is operating, to the fact that a kind of reaction is operating, or a view or a belief, then we're no longer at the mercy of that. It's like we're no longer looking through that filter. Instead, we're looking at it. And it becomes simply part of things as they are, things as they have come to be. It's a natural thing, this agenda operating in the mind, this belief operating in the mind. Unseen, it can create havoc. It can cause problems. Seen, we can use views skillfully when they are helpful views, and we can let go of views that are not so helpful. So there's other ways, or other ways that this things as they are obscured, and one of the main ways is this this phenomenon in the Pali known as papancha, which is, it's often called mental proliferation, but I like the translation the mind run amok. Which is basically what it is, that the mind picks up on something and, you know, doesn't let it go and takes the smallest little thing, a tiny little knee pain, and turns it into knee surgery next week. Our minds do this all the time. And it obscures. I mean, when we're in that state, and, you know, I used to live in that state. I used to live in those worlds of, before I met the practice, it never even crossed my mind that there was any other way to live in these you know, thought worlds. And when we're living in those thought worlds, we have not much contact with things as they are. As one yogi on this retreat I just taught at Spirit Rock, we were talking about this term yata bhuta a lot in the Dharma talks, and one yogi came into my interview and she said, "Well, there's yata bhuta, and then there's yada 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 yada." That's what our minds do. So we can't simply decide, you know, to turn our minds to experience as it is. You know, we can't flip a switch and say, okay, now I'm going to see things as they are, things as they have come to be. I'm going to understand as it actually is my body right now. We can't do that. What we need to do instead is turn our attention towards the things that get in the way of connecting with things as they are. And we can do this. One of the most helpful ways to do this, because often these things that get in the way are hard to see. You know, we're like swimming in this sea of our views and opinions and reactions that are so familiar to us that we don't even recognize them as being anything other than the normal way things are. And so it takes a little bit of skill to begin to uncover these obscurations. Some of them are obvious forms of reactivity. When we're obviously suffering, there's something going on that's obscuring things as they are. Some kind of greed or aversion escalating into an afflictive emotion, anger, frustration, hostility. Turning the attention to just that experience of anger in that moment is things as they are. Can we meet that without judgment about the fact that anger has come to be? There are more subtle views, beliefs operating, that can be maybe a little harder to uncover. Something along the lines of, I'm not capable of doing something. Or a subtle kind of trying in a kind of a still, quiet place in meditation, a subtle trying to maintain that quiet state. That's a very quiet, subtle kind of clinging to the state. So a way into this, to seeing these, is actually quite simple. And my teacher Utejaniya teaches this, to ask yourself the question, what's going on? What is my attitude here? What's my relationship to what's happening? It's amazing, actually, that just opening your mind to the possibility that something else might be going on that you haven't noticed will bring it into relief. So simply checking in from time to time about that to see if there, what the obscurations are, what the filters are. It may not be, there may not be obvious ones functioning at a particular time. But sometimes, and more often than I would expect, when I check in like that, there's something that I've missed. That when it's seen, it's like just, oh, right, that's what's happening. I'm wanting something to be other than it is. That's what's happening. Wanting has arisen. I don't need to change the wanting. And there's actually this interesting like Aikido move that you can make with these energies. It's like when you recognize that energy of wanting has arisen. It has arisen already, remember that. It has already come to be. It is things as they are already. You can't change it. That wanting has come to be. And there's a kind of an energy behind that wanting that if you can feel that or tap into that energy, it's like you can redirect it away from being driven by it towards investigating it, towards understanding it, towards meeting it as it is. And it really does feel like an Aikido move for me. It just kind of feels like this little whoop, quarter turn, shift in relationship to that experience when it's seen. If it's not seen, if that wanting things to be other than they are is not seen, it's going to create some dissatisfaction, some suffering. So this term, yata bhuta, is often connected with another Pali term in the suttas, jnana dasana, which basically means something along the lines of knowledge and vision, or insight. So the term yata bhuta jnana dasana refers to knowledge and vision of things as they are, an insight into things as they are. The direct connecting with things as they are without these filters. So when we can get to that place where there are no filters, that's a state of insight. It's a shift in consciousness that sees things as they actually are, recognizes the impermanence of phenomenon, recognizes the inherent unsatisfactoriness of experience, largely because it's impermanent. It is not satisfactory as a place to look for lasting happiness. And it's not me. It's not mine. It's not who I am. It's a phenomenon arising due to causes and conditions. And this is a huge, great relief, seeing this way. It's putting down the burden of trying to and wanting to see things other than they are. So we have a couple of minutes if there's any comments or questions. Yeah.
So I really enjoyed your treatment of the karma of things as they have come to be. And I'm very confused about things as they actually are. If I imagine a diner and a cook and a merchant and a farmer looking at rice as it actually is, I don't see how all the pieces come together so that we have this theory of rice, that it's something that's grown and sold and cooked and eaten.
That's a very interesting question. That's actually a pretty large question. What you're actually talking about is essentially an area around wisdom of understanding. The example you use reminds me of an example in the commentaries around understanding the distinction between perception and consciousness. And essentially, when in looking at things as they are, it's pointing to perception. It's pointing to rice as it is in terms of seeing it as, you know, white, small, form, shape, color, texture, touch, things as they are in terms of kind of bare experience. But in our normal living, we bring understanding to things beyond that kind of bare perceptual experience. And in the suttas, it talks about the difference between a baby looking at coins, a merchant looking at coins, and a gold seller looking at coins, where the baby just sees that they're form and color, you know, pretty, whatever. The merchant understands that they're value, there's value there. And so that, they say, is some of the difference between the perception and the kind of the act of knowing. And then the third one, the merchant, is where wisdom comes in. That the wisdom understands the difference in value, understands that this one may be counterfeit, this one may be real. So that it's a larger understanding. This is a small, it's kind of not a small, but it's a narrow understanding of things as they are. It's not with the wider view of how these things all fit into the context of living a human life. That's a larger kind of wisdom. So that's a kind of a quick answer to that. So we need to stop. So may you all come to see things as they are.